know, we have to do, I mean, we don't have to do some kind of, you know, formal thing, but I mean, they,
could
anybody have questions?
Sure.
Do you want to do one about church or protest? Or that might be the same thing.
Absolutely, don't give me a choice.
Okay, I'll do church one then. You mentioned about getting over your head as a discipline that the church needs to do more. What are some other, for like our age of the church, like 21st century modern church, like what are some like spirit, quote unquote, spiritual disciplines that you think that we need to be exercising to love God and love others?
Right. That's a really good question. Wow. How much time do I have?
Second question is, how do you know the right thing to protest? Or how do you know you're just not being narcissistic? And
I don't. I definitely don't.
I'm not saying you. I'm saying that in
one.
General.
Yeah. I don't know. That's not a solo endeavor. You know, that's not like a thing. I mean, when I get out and do shows, I mean, I'm usually by myself or I play by myself. But it gives a, you know, it doesn't give an accurate impression of the way this thing works, because you know I have a lot of people around who help you know, stuff like that. I've got several layers of insight and, you know, vetting when it comes to like helping me
process through
figure
stuff.
Out yeah, I mean, I'll typically have instincts on something and then I'll take it to a handful of people and have them tell me what, you know, what they think, and, you know, so that's not like solitary work, for sure. It takes, you know, you need people around you to help with stuff like that. Especially when, depending on what it is that you do, if there's any, if it kicks back at you at all, the doing of it, then you wanna have a good feeling that you know what you're doing, that you've taken a calculated risk. I mean, there have been a few points for me where I would have, well, just in various moments where there's been controversy or where something unexpected will stir somebody the wrong way, whatever. And if I can say that my wife and my pastor and my, you know, few close friends, you know, heard it, knew about it, and know me, and they know why and what it is, then I don't care what anybody else really thinks. That's part of how I'm wired too, is I've got that, I'm short-circuited somewhere where I don't have that part of my personality where I care what people think. I just don't have that. Now I know that I've got other things that are really terrible, but I don't have that. And sometimes it comes in handy and sometimes it's you know, it does me no good service, but. So I've never really had a hard time with that sort of thing. Like moments where stuff like that happens, for me, it's usually like it's evidence that I'm doing my job. Like if people, like right when Mockingbird came out, I was doing a tour in, I was touring around Texas actually, and I guess I was in a really conservative, it probably would have been outside of Dallas or something, and I was playing a show and people hadn't heard, and I'll do this sometimes, people hadn't heard the new song, so it was just in advance of the record coming out, but I was playing mostly all new songs, so people didn't know what they were kind of in for, and I remember playing King of the Kingdom, and had like literally a third of the room clear out. Like a third of the room just visibly up and just out. And
we had, yes.
Well, what's funny is so afterwards
the
No, it didn't even get to the bridge. They didn't even hear to the bridge. But and afterwards the promoter was like really apologetic and just felt terrible, and he was just like, oh, so I can't believe it. People are so disrespectful. I'm like, man, this is like the best night I've had in a month. This is great. Like, because people are listening. I mean, I don't. And I think the misunderstanding comes when people presume that I would wish for them to think like me. That's where the breakdown happens, I think. That they feel like there's a prerequisite to listen to it or to engage with it or even hear the questions that they would need to agree with my conclusions. And I don't think that at all. I don't think there'd be any good that could come from people thinking like me on stuff. I just like to ask questions. You know what I mean? And sometimes I'll wind up with some conclusions in there, but I don't mean to. I mostly like to just ask questions. And so most of the folks who've managed to stick with me for very long, I feel like understand that most of them, I will hear them say things like, I don't agree with most of what you say, but I like the questions you ask, and I reach different conclusions than you do, but I stick around for the questions. So that's usually a pretty good way to look at it. And so, but it's folks who aren't used to that sort of interaction with the music they listen to or whatever it is that just kind of can't hang. And that's okay, because there's just a lot of music out there, and maybe I'm just not for you, you know? And that's okay with me, you know? I mean, I'd rather you go listen to something that makes you happy. Like, don't listen to me if I frustrate you. Go listen to something else, you know? There's just so much music out there, and I don't, you know, I'm not for everybody. I'm really not. So, and I'm not for every season for everybody either. Sometimes people like the stuff for a while, and then they'll start to not like it, and they go and find other music, and that's fine. Because, I mean, as long as I was saying this earlier today, but, like, I feel like I turn over about a third of my audience annually. So I'll lose about a third of my people about every year, and then a third of new people kind of come in and take their place. It just kind of rotates all the time. So, you know, you give me 3 or 4 years, and I'm looking at a whole different group of people sometimes. And then there's those few people who stick around, but that's pretty rare. So sometimes I don't know until it's too late, you know, if it's like, if it was the right thing.
Spiritual disciplines?
Spiritual disciplines, man. I don't know if this is spiritual discipline, but I think we have to, the thing that I have been frustrated with the last few years is like, the whole like loving sinners but hating sin thing. I get hating sin, but the way that people use that, like I'm gonna love the sinner and hate sin, that's like, it's wielded really poorly. I don't disagree with the statement. Theoretically, I don't mind that statement. How can you disagree with it? But that's wielded pretty recklessly, the way that people use a statement like that, on the whole, in my opinion. And I feel like people are, luckily Jesus was not concerned with his reputation being ruined by the people that he hung out with and loved, luckily. And yet we are so concerned with it. And with that, we like to talk about our it being some kind of a damage to our witness and stuff if we're like around, you know, if we're around people and where's the line in terms of loving people and then condoning what they're doing and things like that. It's just so funny how you don't see Jesus really operating that way. He didn't draw those kind of hard lines. He preferred recklessly over-loving rather than fearfully under-loving. That's what he preferred. And now, granted, he wasn't reckless because he you know, loved people perfectly on my behalf, but which liberates me to, if I'm going to err one way or the other, which I'm going to, I'd rather be reckless and over-loving people than be fearful and not loving people because I don't know what to, how to, you know, what are my friends going to say, or what kind of trouble is that going to get me into? I mean, that's the right kind of trouble to be in, to be hanging out with people who are complicated. So like, I guess I would like to see like more Christians kind of running headlong into complicated situations, not thinking about their reputations in those moments, and get in there and just get in there. I mean, that's like, just show up and get in there. I mean, that's the, rather than all of your time and your energy going into processing what's this going to mean though, and what do I need to say at the outset to be clear about where I draw the line about. I mean, you cannot put conditions on love like that. It's really unhealthy to do that, and it's not love when you do that. If you can't provide somebody a safe place just to exist, just to be in the world and exist, they're just, if you think that they're going to be vulnerable with you and you're going to have any place to speak into their lives, you're just wrong. So you need to be able to create space for people to exist, even in all their complication. And so if you're going to do it in such a way that puts a lot of conditions on it, then just don't do it. I mean, you're just wasting everybody's time to say, well, I will love you, but I will hang out with you, but I want to be clear on this. That this and this and this, absolutely not. And this and this and this, and if you wind up thinking this or this or that, or if you do this or this, I'm out. Or if these, I mean, you're not loving anybody like that. And that just drives me crazy. Like, Christians are so concerned with like having all that sorted out before they'll get in and do anything. They just want to have it all sorted out. You're just not going to be able to do that. I mean, Jesus loved to the extent that he was called by the same names as all the sinful people he was hanging out with. They called him by the same sins. They were telling him, they were basically saying he was doing all the same stuff they were doing, and he certainly wasn't. But that's how close he was. Like, that he was so far in there, they almost couldn't tell the difference between him and those people. He wasn't concerned with the people who were pointing. If anything, he reserved his most harsh language for the people who were calling him those names. His concern was the complicated people. That was his concern. That's what he was in it for. He had nothing but hard words for anybody else. And and I think about when a couple of years ago when I wound up on that tour with Jen Knapp, and that was like, there were so many people, even my friends were coming to me and trying to give me all this advice about what I should do, and like what I need to say to her, and like what kind of lines I need to draw with her, and like, because I'd known her for so long, I mean, it was no major revelations. But what was interesting was that you have all these people who feel like they're doing the Lord's work, doing what they think Jesus would do, apparently, out in front of all these shows every night that we were doing, especially after we'd stopped in New York and we took a night off and she went to Larry King and came back. You know, a lot changed, but next week. And you had all of these people with like their picket signs and people freaking out and people like, you know, from the band to the front door, people like freaking out and yelling at her and saying, and all in the name of Jesus. And I was likely reckless in terms of my overloving, like in any situation. However, the result was, you know, there were four people in that band. It was Jen and our road manager and this girl, Amy Kortz, who opened to me. And for whatever reason, I got to be one of those three people in that band with her for those 3 months. And it put me in a place to be able to be with her and to walk through it with her. And so I don't know that I would have made any different choices, but I had preferred to be one of the people who were outside with signs and yelling at her trying to talk sense into her, or would I rather somehow have been somebody who gets to sit with her every night, you know, and get to be a voice of counsel for her in that moment. I prefer the latter. So, but Christians are just really preoccupied with their reputations and with their witness. And these words don't mean anything. They don't, not anymore. I mean, like if you got a word and 10 people have 10 different definitions of it, just stop using it. You got to find a new word. There's nothing holy, there's nothing sacred about particular words. We need to reframe things, reimagine new language, repurpose words. You know, that's a whole other deal. But the way that Christians use like really loaded terms, if you're a communicator and you're trying to communicate things to people, and somebody asks you a question, trying to get a simple answer out of you for a question for which there's no simple answer, don't answer it. I think is a pretty good, or do what Jesus would do and answer with a follow, ask a follow-up. You know, but like, it just drives me nuts the way that, I mean, language is really important, and Christians don't seem concerned to like make sure everybody understands. Like Bob Dylan, like in the 60s, there's this great footage of him, his second, 63, 64, his second trip to the UK, he'd become a huge star since he'd been there last, and everywhere went, everybody was asking questions. I mean, he was doing interview after interview after interview, everybody. And there's this amazing footage of Time Magazine interviewing him. He gives this guy such a hard time. Time Magazine interviewing him, and this guy asked him this big long question. And basically, the end of the interview, Bob makes the guy define every word of the question for him. His definition of every word in that question. He's like, how can I answer that question? How can I possibly answer that question? I have no idea what you're even asking me. We have completely different definitions for all these words. So if I answer a question, I'm not answering your question. But if you think I am, then you're putting words in my mouth. Because, so if somebody asks you, even if somebody asks you if you're a Christian, I would ask a follow-up. And see, some people will say, oh, you're being ashamed. You're ashamed of the faith. You're ashamed of Jesus. No. I mean, the word Christian, incidentally, was, I don't know if there's any example. I don't know that there's any example in the Bible of the word Christian being self-applied as a term. It was a public verdict. It was never self-applied. People would see people doing stuff, and they'd say, oh, those must be the people who follow Jesus. Those must be the Christians. They didn't march into town saying, here we are, we're Christians. It wasn't self-implied. It was a public verdict. Almost, I mean, maybe 100% of the time when it was used in the first century. So I think we should kind of maybe take a cue. Because that's such a loaded term now. You know, like this guy David Kahneman, who's head of the Barna Research Group, wrote this book, Unchristian, some years ago. If you've not read it, it's really good. And you'll never want to use that term again after you read it, because he, you know, be careful how you use it, because he put, there was a statistic in there. They asked, Barna Research Group asked non-Christian adolescents, 16 to 35, non-Christians. They asked them, what is, when you hear the word Christian, what is the first thing that you think of? Just, what do you think? Christian. 93% said, somebody who hates gay people. 93%. Now, it doesn't matter how I feel. It doesn't matter what my church does. It doesn't matter what you do. If that's the perception, 93% of the perception, essentially, somebody's walking up to you, for all you know. 93% of people are walking up to you and saying, hey, do you hate gay people? How would you answer that question? It wouldn't be a simple answer.
Is there ever a way to redeem, like, certain words back to what, you know what I mean? Like,
I think there is.
Totally hear what you're saying, but then are there certain words, though, that you can't necessarily give up and rather need to try to bring back to God's definition?
Yes. Yeah. And as long as the whole time you're aware that, depending on the word, there's nothing sacred about it. You know, like, we need to be willing to let go of words too. But I think you can. And I think in any way, we're in the redemption business, so I think you should if you can, absolutely. So I think the way you would do that is the element of surprise. That's how you do it. So you disrupt someone's idea of what the word means by asking the follow-up, by not letting them get away with it, like by giving a complex answer to a question that is complex, as opposed to giving a simple answer to that same question, which doesn't exist. Do the extra work. And then, on the other side of them being sufficiently confused, then tell them that you're a Christian. And let that be a total disruption to their idea of what Christianity is. But I wouldn't front load it with the term. You know, Don Miller, who's I've known for more than a decade, he's great at this. He will sit, I've watched him sit with people, and they will ask him questions. And he will absolutely, by the end of the thing, when he finally, if it comes around, I've seen him do this very thing, and he'll start talking about Jesus at the end. And people are like, what? You're speaking where tonight? At what church? Like, what are you talking, are you a Christian? And they don't mean that, like, they mean that in a good way. Because they're like, we've had this great conversation. You've totally respected me, and you've dignified me, and I kind of agree with you on most of this. And I mean, I'm shocked at your politics. I'm shocked at your worldview. And I'm shocked at, and you're a Christian? I guess I don't. Maybe I didn't know what I thought about Christians. Like, because that's, are you a unicorn? I mean, I've never met a Christian like you. Like, that's a really good way to redeem a term. But you still have to push. You know, you can't lead with it. Because as soon as you say it, it's the grid through which people look at it. I mean, really hard categories like that are never helpful. They're never helpful. And I remember being in my 20s, and I love categories like that. I love people say, especially when it came to theology and stuff like that, which I was a real buff into for a long time, because I was getting a nickel's worth of a seminary education by all my buddies who were in seminary, and I was on the road with nothing to do, so they would send me all these books and tell me those books to read, and I read them all. And I was super into it for a while, but I'm a fighter. Like, that's how I'm wired. I'm a fighter. I don't put my arms around people and weep. I get in front of them and put my fists up. I'm a fighter. And so I loved, that just gave me those were my least loving years. The years where I studied theology, like really heavily, really got down in the nitty gritty of like the systematic theology, really got into it, really defined myself in terms of my, all my categories and whatever, you know, are you amillennial this or that, or are you post-millennial this or that? I mean, you know, like I was with a ready answer. And I thought that was the point. But the problem with that is that if your theology never converts into ethics, so if what you believe about God never informs the way that you love God or treat people, then it's really doing you a major disservice. and you're just really nothing more than a, you know, a ringing cymbal or a clanging gong at that point. And I have super airtight theology, or so I thought, for a long. In as far as God is system, it can be systematized, which He cannot be. I had it down, and that was like, and I was super. I was fine. People would say, "Are you a thisist or a thatist, or are you into thisism or thatism?" And I would always say, "Yes, oh yeah, I'm way big time into that. That's my thing." And the thing is, I had no idea what they meant. What if aliens came down from space and found me? And they, where they come from, the word Christian means somebody who, you know, eats baby heads or something. I don't know, something just terrible and despicable. But that's what the word means, where they come from. And they come and they say, "Hey, are you a Christian?" I'd be like, "Oh yeah, big time." They're like, "Dude eats baby heads." Like, we're not, that's, you know, I mean, they want to. Like, but that's what's happening, like, most of the time. That's what's happening, you know, with people. Like, so you really got to be careful with that stuff. So I don't do it anymore. Somebody asks me, do I believe in this particular type of theology or that particular type of theology? I'll ask several follow-up questions before I'll even think about answering that question. Because I don't know what's been done to them. I don't know what they believe about that. I don't know what their experience is with all the words they just told me. You want to find that stuff out, you know. So I just wish Christians would do more of it. But we're in love with language. We're obsessed with our terms. And most of the time it feels like to me, Christians are more concerned with converting people to their particular set of words than they are really wanting people to meet Jesus. They're more like, "No, but you have to say it the way I say it, though." Because for a long time that was happening to me. People would ask me these questions, and I would say, "Well..." And I would say, like the people who walk up to you at the mall and want to talk to you about Jesus and follow you around the mall. I don't know if people still do that, but they sure did when I was a kid. And I was like, no, I'm a Christian. And they're like, "Well, but," and they'd ask me these specific questions, specific words, and I'm like, "Well, I don't know. I don't know if I'd say it like that. I don't know if I quite believe. I don't know." And so they'll evangelize you to their set of terms, and it's definitely start getting into theology. You know, boy, they really want you to say it a particular way. And if you don't, they will evangelize you until you use their particular terms. And that is just such an unbelievable waste of time. So pointless. So I think you just have to discern the moments where it's like, all right, these words are doing more harm than good. And it's time to disrupt it. You know. But Christians are, man, they're obsessed with their terms. And none of the terms mean anything. What evangelical means nothing. At this point in history, evangelical means nothing. It doesn't, because 10 people have 10 different definitions for it. You know, there's a lot of words like that that just don't mean anything. So we gotta stop using them. And I think the people would find it really refreshing if they found us talking about our spirituality in a way that made any sense. But instead, we're in love with these like very coded words and these like loaded and coded words, and you're waiting to hear it. Like, yeah, but did he use the word? Whatever, did he say that? Because if he didn't, then I'm not sure. Probably need to work on his eschatology. It doesn't sound stable to me. It doesn't sound straight. So, anyway.
I'm
a loudmouth. Yeah.
I've got a softball question. Mm. So we have a 5-year-old who knows your music, sings it, and likes it. Do your own children like your music?
There's no way I like my music. I don't know. We don't listen to our records.
What music do you listen to?
Our kids, I mean, they listen to whatever they want. I mean, we play them a lot of different stuff.
What do you play them?
Because
at this point, I feel like we have kids too, and we're like trying to, you know, set a good foundation for music and stuff.
My kids love dance music and hip-hop music, but it's hard for me to find stuff I can play for them.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Like, clean.
But we're embarrassed. Because
I don't buy clean versions of records. I mean, I just don't. There's no way I'm going to do that. So, because that's not what I want. I mean, I want
unadulterated.
I want what the artist really wrote. I want to hear it in that language because I want to hear what he's really trying to say and what's, you know. And so I can't play a lot of that for my kids, but I found some that's good, that's clean, like it's intended to be. Like I've got several buddies in the. And they don't like any more than I would like having to say, but you know, like Christian hip hop,
which doesn't exist instantly. Like I said before, it's a marketing term. It's a marketing term though, and there it works. But like whose records are actually phenomenal, like Christian or not, it doesn't, you know, but they make really excellent hip hop.
So what are some of those names in that?
Propaganda. If you know this guy, he's out of California, out of LA, and he is phenomenal. Propaganda. You can get his records for free. At least his newest record, which is called Excellent. Excellent. You can get on Noise Trade for free. Noise Trade is not Propaganda. But Lecrae is really super. There's a reason why he sold so many records last year, and he was like number one on the hip hop chart on iTunes, like almost every country in the world that week. That's because he makes really killer hip hop. I mean, it's, you know, and but like other than that, like our kids like the Beatles, and we play a lot of that for them, and we're trying to take them back to some of the sources. You know, like we don't want them listening to like too much super modern stuff.
Right.
We'd rather take them back to who all those people listen to.
Exactly.
And let them journey from there. But you know, we make them listen to Dylan, and they don't love Dylan, but will. They really like Arcade Fire. We play a lot of Arcade Fire. We have a lot of like usually whatever we buy on vinyl, because they like putting records on the record player. So it's, they'll pick out vinyl and they'll want it, because that's like they can do it. They'll get it out. So it's like even when my boy was he was really young. He barely talk. I don't know how old he was. Maybe 2 or 3. He was just and we would ask him what he wants to listen to, and he would say Arcade Fire on vinyl. Okay, fire and vinyl. That was his answer all the time. And so yeah, I don't know what else they listen to. We have a lot of friends who make music being in Nashville, so we play our friends' music for them. We got this band called Leagues that's really, really cool in Nashville, and I don't know where all they tour. They've probably been up here, but it's got Thad Cockrell, who's their lead singer, and he's one of the best singers I've ever heard in my life. And they love that stuff. It's like it's just anything that they can get them up out of their seat. You know, so it's definitely not my music. Nobody dances to my music. I'll work on that. But
Stockholm Syndrome.
You can dance. You can dance to Stockholm Syndrome. Yeah, you can dance in some of that.
Freddie B.
Well, that's a slow jam.
That's a slow jam.
That's a slow jam. But you can dance to Gene and Jimmy. But that's tough because it's heavy. That's Michael. That's Michael Jackson.
That riff
and
that?
Yeah. That sounds heavy though.
Has your music writing process changed with like, you know, as you've had sort of more electronic music?
I probably write really differently when I'm writing with drum machines than I do with guitar. For sure.
I was gonna request I Love Hate You, but I don't
know if I can play that. Yeah, I Love Hate You. I think I could. I'm pretty sure I've done it before.
Yeah.
But the songs have to fundamentally change. So when I make some of those kind of records, I wind up having to get out, and it's like I feel like I'm covering somebody else's song. Like I have to go to it and just pick up a guitar and like try to figure out how to do it, like just from scratch, because there's no guitar on those songs.
Yeah.
Like there's barely any guitar on that record, and I think I can play about half that record. But there, I mean, I cannot play Jimmy Jimmy on acoustic guitar. And there's just no way to do it. And I can't play What You Give Up to Get It on acoustic guitar. There's no way to do it. It's all about the groove, you know, of the song and like what's happening in the rhythm department and the bass department.
Did you do it all yourself? All the...
I did.
What programs?
I mostly use Native Instruments stuff. I Love Even Battery. Spectrasonic stuff. Stylus is their thing. And then between Stylus and Battery, that's probably 90% of what I use to program. But I'm a little bit of a mad scientist. Yeah, but what's crazy is like the new record I wrote on acoustic guitar, and I played everything on that record, and I programmed all the drums. There's no real drums on that whole record. But so it doesn't have to sound electronic. It depends on the samples you're using. So if you have really good samples of real drums, then it sounds like real drums. So, I mean, like this new record is as electronic in that regard as Stockholm Syndrome was or Feedback was. It's just I'm using different sounds. I'm using organic sounds, but it's all programmed. All of it. There's not a stick hit a drum on that record. I sat there on a little... I tapped it out. So. But,
how do you feel about when people ask you to play like old songs, like in cadence?
I'm thrilled that people have songs they are connected to and resonate with and love and wish for me to play. I don't. I'm thrilled. If anybody has any song that means something to them, I don't. And I'm not saying I'm always going to play them, but I love. But I love. No, I'm. Gosh, I would. I mean, I would never bristle at a request. Gosh, somebody actually loves a song to call it out. I mean, I'm thrilled. So the only old Kamen song I won't play is Bus Driver. The only one. I just won't. Period. I mean, just you could be the promoter of the show. And you could be the only one there. It could just be me and you. And you paid me to come and only play for you. I would not play Bus Driver. That's how I feel about it. I tried to give it to somebody a few years ago. There was a guy who came to a show and he came to 2 or 3 in a row and he kept asking for it. And I said, hey man, are you a musician by any chance? And he said, oh yeah. And I said, okay, I will, if you will take over the responsibilities for this song, for requests for this song, I will give it to you. I will sign the publishing over to you. I will give you the song. I will put your name as the author and composer of the song if you will take it and I can start sending people to you. It's like, because then I can say, it's just not my song. So, it's just not my song. I know the guy, and I'll give you his email address, and you can talk to him. I don't have any responsibility for that.
But I've heard you sing like you 2 songs before mm-hmm. as well. So.
Oh, you know, I'll do covers. I love doing covers.
Whatever happened to Democracy?
I ran it for 2 years, and then I just needed a break. It was really fun. It was super, super fun. But like, I just couldn't. It was just stress at the end of the month every month. And the original plan was, I'll do them all in a month. I'll record all 12 in a month, and then it's just a matter of putting them out from the month. And that's never what happens. So it'd be like the 28th. Crap! I got to record the month. So what's left on the list? I'll go through and try to pick one out, and then I would go. And it was fun to do, but. I got too busy.
Yeah.
Like, I've got too many part-time jobs. I've got too many things I do now. So I just couldn't keep doing that. It was really fun, though. Yeah.
I have a question, quick. What, like, obviously to you, like...
And then we'll clear out of here.
I feel like your voice is really interesting in, like, what you see in the world. And, like, how you choose what you say is also really interesting. Because if you don't... Like, if you show too much restraint, you end up, like... not saying anything, you show too little,
mm-hmm.
and it's really dangerous. Like, what influences the restraint that you show in what you speak up about? I don't know, just because it's like...
I don't
like,
feel like I have very much in some in some moments. But, I don't know, I mean... I don't feel like I have a lot of say in what I make records about. I really don't. I feel like that process for me is completely integrated. So the things that I put on records are the things that I love or hate or am frustrated about or, you know, I mean, like, so whatever in my personal life, like the things that my friends and I sit on our porches and drink wine and talk about are the things I make records about. So whatever it is that's like frustrating me in my life in general or whatever it is that I'm seeing, like, so the job of an artist, the job description of any artist is to look at the world and tell you what they see. That's the job. And year over year, the world I'm looking at is a little different, and I'm different looking at it.
Yeah.
So I see different things, right? But, you know, like the year before I put Mockingbird out, I was really seeing a lot of like the political idolatry of in my community and the people around me, and it was driving me crazy. And so I wrote a bunch of songs about it, and I've never felt like I've exercised a lot of control over that sort of thing. Like that's just what shows up. The other weird thing about my process is that I will write 12 songs in a couple of months, right before I'm supposed to record a record, and then I'll record them all, and then I will not write another song for a year. Or 18 months. Literally not a song, not a line, not a verse. Nothing. And I'll just be able to just be, it's just a totally dry. And it's been this way for 20 years, literally. And I won't know what's gonna happen next. I don't know what. And I'm always on the lookout for coordinates, you know, like things that like I notice 3 or 4 times or that somebody's, you know, something that comes to my attention that I just keep hearing about or something that just keeps happening that I just keep observing or whatever it is. And I'll make notes about that stuff. I'll try to kind of the coordinates. But it's not till all of a sudden the songs start showing up again that I have any idea. I'm as surprised as anybody when these records come out and what's on them. Like looking back on my discography, I'm shocked at some of where it's gone. I didn't see it coming.
I didn't see this record coming, I'll tell you that. I really didn't. But you just, but so for me, when the songs show up is when I know it's time, right? And when I know, because I've never written extra. Like literally every single song I've ever written, I've recorded. So you could go back to the first Cavemen's record, and if you listen to all the songs all the way through this one, you've heard every song I've written. I don't have extras. Like some of my friends write a bunch of songs and they like choose. I'm given exactly the songs that I need, and I record them all. And so I don't have a lot of, even editorial choices about it. I just, well, here's 10 songs, and that's all I've got. I'm gonna record all 10, and I don't, you know, hope it goes over. But that's my process, so it's like, so I don't feel like I've got a lot of say in it. I honestly don't feel like I've got a lot to do with it. I just kind of, I wait, and then the songs start to kind of come, and then once I get, and then I kind of will pick up on, and usually I know when it's going to happen, and I know, you know, when I see something enough times or I'm preoccupied with something for long enough, I'm like, man, this is worth saying, this is where this thing's going. But by that time, it's a foregone conclusion. It's already gone there. Like, I'm already going there.
Yeah.
And then the songs just kind of, they show up, I record them, and then I put it out and hope for the best. And then, you know, 14 months go by, and then all of a sudden, maybe another one shows up, maybe, you know, songs are showing up again. So it's weird. It's a weird, it's not, I mean, it's, there's nothing, it's an odd process. But it's been, I trust it at this point, because it's been like this for so long. Like even the Cadence records, I remember being so stressed about writing 5 or 6, 7 songs. And it'd be like the month before I knew we were going to be in the studio, I'd have not a song. And all of a sudden, like, they just show up, and it's a mysterious process.
Yeah.
You know, it's not science, it's art. I wish I could figure it out. But if I sit down in the time between and try, I mean, it's just nothing good comes. It's a total waste of time. So I just do other things.
I have a really random question.
Keep myself busy, sure.
This isn't like deep or anything. I'm going to Nashville in a few weeks.
Oh yeah.
And I want to know like what place would you recommend?
For what?
Eat or coffee?
Okay, coffee. I'll give you two.
Okay. Because I have one that I'm wondering.
Really?
Well.
Okay, so the best cup of coffee in Nashville is going to be on the east side of Nashville. It's like you can walk to my house from it, but it's called Barista Parlor.
Barista Parlor?
Barista Parlor. It is, no, oh man. It's, my friends who come in from New York and LA and all the places where all the cool stuff happens, I mean, they come to Barista Parlor and they'll tell me they don't need anything like it. I mean, it's like, it's serious. They've been covered in like all these, you know, like, so definitely find, I mean, it's like one of those places, they're so serious.
Mm-hmm.
About what they're doing in there. It looks like a meth lab. And Nashville has hipsters, so you're going to want to prepare yourself. People who go to Barista Parlor are pretty serious. Your barista will be much, much cooler than you or me. They're very, very cool. They're rock stars. So definitely Barista Parlor. Second to that is going to be a place called Crema.
Okay.
In my opinion. That they were the most serious cup of coffee in Nashville until the Barista Parlor showed up. Where have you heard?
How do you spell Crema?
C-R-E-M-A.
Okay.
Where have you heard about?
I know, I've just heard about Frothy Monkey a lot.
Frothy Monkey, and there's two locations now.
Yeah, so that was my other question, was like, which one's better?
Yeah, I mean, if I was you, I would go to the one on 8th Avenue, because it's the one, it's the original.
Okay.
And it's good. It's a good place. I mean, like, coffee shops, it's not all about coffee. It's also about...
Like,
it's about, it's like what, how the space feels and how much power they have for computers. But like Barista Parlor is a nightmare. There's nowhere to charge a computer in that place.
That's okay.
They have Wi-Fi, but there's nowhere to charge a computer. So whereas Crema, I mean, they've got, it's great, ample power. But and Frothy Monkey's the same way. But like there's a place on the east side close to my house called Ugly Mugs, and their coffee's not great, but man, it's a good place to hang out. So I go there and I drink bad coffee because I like that place. You know? So there's that. Now in terms of food, what's your favorite kind of food?
My favorite kind of food.
What's your favorite general? What's your genre? Give me a genre. Asian, Mexican,
barbecue.
Asian?
Yeah.
Okay. What about Thai? Does that qualify?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's where you want to go. There's a place on
I'm getting like attention.
8th Avenue, actually. Boy, you just go over and stay on 8th
Avenue.
Okay,
stay on 8th Avenue.
Called The Smiling Elephant.
Okay.
This is a big thing in Nashville. All the restaurants are an adjective and an animal. Seriously, the Laughing Cow, the Silly Goose, the Smiling Elephant. I mean, I can name a dozen. The Frothy Monkey. that's a thing. Is there like a thing? Is there like an app that generates those? You just hit a thing and it locks in, and you can hit it again and randomize. But anyway, so seriously, Smiling Elephant, man, and it's like if you want more garden variety but excellent Thai food, I would go to Thai Phuket, which looks like they could drive it away. It looks like you're in a trailer. It doesn't look like much, but you gotta trust me on this. It's really good.
Okay.
It's right off the highway.
Nice.
Over near East Nashville, which is right. And we don't have a lot of good sushi. We have a little bit of decent sushi, but not much. We definitely have no good Chinese food. There's no good Chinese food. And there's no
in America.
Well, yeah. But then there's nowhere to get dim sum. There's nowhere to get there's a few decent Vietnamese places, but Smelling Elephant's gonna do you right. Second to that, there's so many good places. So don't miss that.
Right.
Just go and get on 8th Avenue.
Sounds good.
You'll be set.
I will. I appreciate it.
Oh yeah. Gosh, I hope you enjoy it. What are you coming to town for?
I'm going to Hutch Movie.
Oh yeah. Oh man, that's cool.
Yeah. I was lucky to get in.
That's what I hear, man.
I know. Well, a friend had a ticket and then couldn't go. So.
It's the craziest thing, the way they built that thing up.
Yeah.
Man. Oh, you'll have a blast. You'll be fine. Anyway, I really appreciate you guys being flexible and hanging out.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
All right. Thanks so much.
Nice to meet you.